The Man That Was Used Up by Edgar Allan Poe. I cannot just now remember when or where I first made the acquaintance of that truly fine-looking fellow, Brevet Brigadier General John A.B.C. Smith. Someone did introduce me to the gentleman, I'm sure, at some public meeting I know very well, held about something of great importance, no doubt, at some place or other, I feel convinced, whose name I have unaccountably forgotten. The truth is that the introduction was attended, upon my part, with a degree of anxious embarrassment which operated to prevent any definite impression of either time or place. I am continually nervous. This, with me, is a family failing, and I can't help it. In especial, the slightest appearance of mystery, of any point I cannot exactly comprehend, puts me at once into a pitiable state of agitation. There was something, as it were, remarkable. Yes, remarkable. Although this is but a feeble term to express my full meaning, about the entire individuality of the personage in question. He was perhaps 6 feet in height, and of a presence singularly commanding. There was an air distingué pervading the whole man, which spoke of high breeding, and hinted at high birth. Upon this topic, the topic of Smith's personal appearance, I have a kind of melancholy satisfaction in being minute. His head of hair would have done honour to a Brutus. Nothing could be more richly flowing, or possess a brighter gloss. It was of a jetty black, which was also the colour, or more properly the no colour, of his unimaginable whiskers. You perceive I cannot speak of these latter without enthusiasm. It is not too much to say that they were the handsomest pair of whiskers under the sun. At all events, they encircled, and at times partially overshadowed, a mouth utterly unequalled. Here were the most entirely even and the most brilliantly white of all conceivable teeth. From between them, upon every proper occasion, issued a voice of surpassing clearness, melody, and strength. In the matter of eyes, also, my acquaintance was pre-eminently endowed. Either one of such a pair was worth a couple of the ordinary ocular organs. They were of a deep hazel, exceedingly large and lustrous, and there was perceptible about them, ever and anon, just that amount of interesting obliquity which gives pregnancy to expression. The bust of the general was unquestionably the finest bust I ever saw. For your life you could not have found a fault with its wonderful proportions. This rare peculiarity set off to great advantage a pair of shoulders which would have called up a blush of conscious inferiority into the countenance of the marble Apollo. I have a passion for fine shoulders, and may I say that I never beheld them in perfection before. The arms altogether were admirably modelled, nor were the lower limbs less superb. These were, indeed, the ne plus ultra of good legs. Every connoisseur in such matters admitted the legs to be good. There was neither too much flesh nor too little, neither rudeness nor fragility. I could not imagine a more graceful curve than that of the os femoris, and there was just that due gentle prominence in the rear of the fibula which goes to the conformation of a properly proportioned calf. I wish to God my young and talented friend Ciponcipino the sculptor had seen the legs of Breve Brigadier General John A.B.C. Smith. But although men so absolutely fine-looking are neither as plenty as reasons or blackberries, still I could not bring myself to believe that the remarkable something to which I alluded just now, that the odd air of je ne sais quoi which hung about my new acquaintance, lay altogether, or indeed at all, in the supreme excellence of his bodily endowments. Perhaps it might be traced to the manner. Yet here again I could not pretend to be positive. There was a primness, not to say stiffness, in his carriage, a degree of measured, and if I may so express it, of rectangular precision attending his every movement, which, observed in a more diminutive figure, would have had the least little savour in the world of affectation, pomposity, or constraint, but which, noticed in a gentleman of his undoubted dimensions, was readily placed to the account of reserve hauteur, of a commendable sense, in short, of what is due to the dignity of colossal proportion. The kind friend who presented me to General Smith whispered in my ear some few words of comment upon the man. He was a remarkable man, a very remarkable man, indeed one of the most remarkable men of the age. He was an especial favourite, too, with the ladies, chiefly on account of his high reputation for courage. In that point he is unrivalled. Indeed, he's a perfect desperado, a downright fire-eater, and no mistake, said my friend, here dropping his voice excessively low, and thrilling me with the mystery of his tone. A downright fire-eater, and no mistake. Showed that, I should say, to some purpose in the late tremendous swamp fight away down south with the Bugaboo and Kickapoo Indians. Here my friend opened his eyes to some extent. Bless my soul! Blood and thunder and all that! Prodigies of valour! Heard him, of course. You know he's the man... Man alive, how do you do? Why, how are you? Very glad to see you indeed. Here interrupted the general himself, seizing my companion by the hand as he drew near, and bowing stiffly but profoundly as I was presented. I then thought, and I think so still, that I never heard a clearer nor a stronger voice, nor beheld a finer set of teeth. But I must say that I was sorry for the interruption just at that moment, as, owing to the whispers and insinuations aforesaid, my interest had been greatly excited in the hero of the Bugaboo and Kickapoo campaign. However, the delightfully luminous conversation of Breve Brigadier General John A.B.C. Smith soon completely dissipated this chagrin. My friend leaving us immediately, we had quite a long tête-à-tête, and I was not only pleased, but really instructed. I never heard a more fluent talker, or a man of greater general information. With becoming modesty, he forbore, nevertheless, to touch upon the theme I had just then most at heart. I mean the mysterious circumstances attending the Bugaboo War, and on my own part, what I conceived to be a proper sense of delicacy forbade me to broach the subject, although, in truth, I was exceedingly tempted to do so. I perceived, too, that the gallant soldier preferred topics of philosophical interest, and that he delighted especially in commenting upon the rapid march of mechanical invention. Indeed, lead him where I would, this was a point to which he invariably came back. "There is nothing at all like it," he would say. "We are a wonderful people and live in a wonderful age. Parachutes and railroads, man-traps and spring-guns, our steamboats are upon every sea, and the Nassau balloon packet is about to run regular trips, fare either way only £20 sterling, between London and Timbuktu. And who shall calculate the immense influence upon social life, upon arts, upon commerce, upon literature, which will be the immediate result of the great principles of electromagnetics? Nor is this all, let me assure you. There is really no end to the march of invention. The most wonderful, the most ingenious, and, let me add, Mr. Thompson, I believe is your name, let me add, I say, the most useful, the most truly useful mechanical contrivances are daily springing up like mushrooms, if I may so express myself, or more figuratively, like grasshoppers. Like grasshoppers, Mr. Thompson, about us, and around us. Thompson, to be sure, is not my name. But it is needless to say that I left General Smith with a heightened interest in the man, with an exalted opinion of his conversational powers, and a deep sense of the valuable privileges we enjoy in living in this age of mechanical invention. My curiosity, however, had not been altogether satisfied, and I resolved to prosecute immediate inquiry among my acquaintances, touching the brevet brigadier general himself, and particularly respecting the tremendous advents quorum pars magna fuit during the Bogaboo and Kickapoo campaign. The first opportunity which presented itself, and which, Horresco referens, I did not in the least scruple to seize, occurred at the church of the Reverend Dr. Drumumup, where I found myself established one Sunday, just at sermon time, not only in the pew, but by the side of that worthy and communicative little friend of mine, Miss Tabitha. Thus seated, I congratulated myself, and with much reason, upon the flattering state of affairs. If any person knew anything about Brevet Brigadier General John A.B.C. Smith, that person, it was clear to me, was Miss Tabitha. We telegraphed a few signals, and then commenced, sotto voce, a brisk tête-à-tête. "Smith?" said she, in reply to my very earnest inquiry. "Smith? Why, not General John A.B.C.? Oh, bless me! I thought you knew all about him. This is a wonderfully inventive age. Horrid affair, that. A bloody set of wretches, those Kickapoos. Fought like a hero. Prodigies of valour. Immortal renown. Smith? Brevet Brigadier General John A.B.C. Why, you know, he's the man."
"Man!" here broke in Dr. Drumumup at the top of his voice, and with a thump that came near knocking the pulpit about our ears. "Man that is born of woman hath but a short time to live. He cometh up and is cut down like a flower." I started to the extremity of the pew, and perceived by the animated looks of the divine that the wrath which had nearly proved fatal to the pulpit had been excited by the whispers of the lady and myself. There was no help for it, so I submitted with a good grace, and listened, in all the martyrdom of dignified silence, to the balance of that very capital discourse.
File 2.
Next evening found me a somewhat late visitor at the Rantipole Theatre, but I felt sure of satisfying my curiosity at once by merely stepping into the box of those exquisite specimens of affability and omniscience, the Misses Arabella and Miranda Cognoscenti. That fine tragedian climax was doing Iago to a very crowded house, and I experienced some little difficulty in making my wishes understood, especially as our box was next to the slips and completely overlooked the stage. "Smith," said Miss Arabella, as she at length comprehended the purport of my inquiry. "Smith? Why, not General John A.B.C.?"
"Smith?" inquired Miranda musingly.
"God bless me, did you ever behold a finer figure?"
"Never, madam, but do tell me."
"Are so inimitable grace."
"Never, upon my word. But pray inform me."
"Are so just an appreciation of stage effect."
"Madam."
"Or a more delicate sense of the true beauties of Shakespeare." "Be so good as to look at that leg."
"Oh, the devil."
And I turned again to her sister.
"Smith," said she,
"why, not General John A.B.C. Oh, horrid affair that, wasn't it? Great wretches, those bugaboos, savage and so. But we live in a wonderfully inventive age. Smith, oh yes, great man, perfect desperado, immortal renown, prodigies of valor. Never heard." This was given in a scream. "Bless my soul. Why, he's the man."
"Mandragora, not all the drowsy syrups of the world shall ever medicine thee to that sweet sleep which thou owedst yesterday."
Here roared out Climax just in my ear, and shaking his fist in my face all the time, in a way that I couldn't stand, and I wouldn't. I left the Mrs. Cognoscenti immediately, went behind the scenes forthwith, and gave the beggarly scoundrel such a thrashing as I trust he will remember to the day of his death. At the soiree of the lovely widow, Mrs. Kathleen O'Trump, I was confident that I should meet with no similar disappointment. Accordingly, I was no sooner seated at the card-table with my pretty hostess for a vis-à-vis than I propounded those questions the solution of which had become a matter so essential to my peace.
"Smith," said my partner, "why, not General John A.B.C.? Oh, horrid affair that, wasn't it? Diamonds, did you say? Oh, terrible wretches, those kickapoos. We're playing whist, if you please, Mr. Tattle. However, this is the age of invention, most certainly the age, one may say, the age par excellence. Speak French? Oh, quite a hero, perfect desperado. No hearts, Mr. Tattle? I don't believe it. Oh, immortal renown and all that. Prodigies of valor. Never heard? Why, bless me, he's the man."
"Man? Captain Man?"
Here screamed some little feminine interloper from the furthest corner of the room.
"Are you talking about Captain Man and the duel? Oh, I must hear. Do tell. Go on, Mrs. O'Trump. Oh, do now go on.
And go on, Mrs. O'Trump did. All about a certain Captain Man, who was either shot or hung, or should have been both shot and hung. Yes, Mrs. O'Trump, she went on, and I went off. There was no chance of hearing anything further that evening in regard to Brevet Brigadier General John A.B.C. Smith. Still, I consoled myself with the reflection that the tide of ill luck would not run against me forever, and so determined to make a bold push for information at the rout of that bewitching little angel, the graceful Mrs. Pirouette.
"Smith,"
said Mrs. P., as we twirled about together in a pas de zephyr.
"Smith, why, not General John A.B.C.? Oh, dreadful business, that of the bugaboos, wasn't it? Terrible creatures, those Indians. Oh, do turn out your toes. I'm really ashamed of you. Men of great courage, poor fellow. But this is a wonderful age for invention. Oh, dear me, I'm out of breath. Huh. Quite a desperado. Prodigies of valor. Never heard. Oh, I can't believe it. Oh, I shall have to sit down and enlighten you. Smith? Why, he's the man. Manfred, I tell you,
here bawled out Miss Barbleu, as I led Mrs. Pirouette to a seat.
Did anybody hear the like? It's Manfred, I say, and not at all by any means Man Friday.
Here Miss Barbleu beckoned to me in a very peremptory manner, and I was obliged, willy-nilly, to leave Mrs. P. for the purpose of deciding a dispute touching the title of a certain poetical drama of Lord Byron's. Although I pronounced, with great promptness, that the true title was Man Friday, and not by any means Man Fred, yet when I returned to seek Mrs. Pirouette, she was not to be discovered, and I made my retreat from the house in a very bitter spirit of animosity against the whole race of the Barbleurs. Matters had now assumed a really serious aspect, and I resolved to call at once upon my particular friend, Mr. Theodore Sinovit, for I knew that here at least I should get something like definite information.
"Smith,"
said he, in his well-known peculiar way of drawling out his syllables.
"Smith? Why, not General John A.B.C. Savage affair, that, with the kickapoos, wasn't it?
Say, don't you think so? Perfect desperado. Great pity, upon my honor. Wonderfully inventive age. Prodigies of valor. By the by, did you ever hear about Captain Man?"
"Oh, Captain Man be damned," said I. "Please go on with your story." Oh, well, quite la même chose, as we say in France. Smith, eh? Brigadier General John A.B.C. I say."
Here Mr. Sinovit thought proper to put his finger to the side of his nose.
"I say, you don't mean to insinuate now, really and truly and conscientiously, that you don't know all about that affair of Smith's as well as I do, eh? Smith? John A.B.C. Why, bless me, he's the man,
Mr. Sinovit," said I imploringly. "Is he the man in the mask?"
"No,"
said he, looking wise. "Not the man in the moon." This reply I considered a pointed and positive insult, and so left the house at once in high dudgeon, with a firm resolve to call my friend Mr. Sinovit to a speedy account for his ungentlemanly conduct and ill-breeding. In the meantime, however, I had no notion of being thwarted touching the information I desired. There was one resource left me yet. I would go to the fountainhead. I would call forthwith upon the general himself, and demand, in explicit terms, a solution of this abominable piece of mystery. Here, at least, there should be no chance for equivocation. I would be plain, positive, peremptory, as short as Pycrust, as concise as Tacitus or Montesquieu. It was early when I called, and the general was dressing, but I pleaded urgent business, and was shown at once into his bedroom by an old negro valet, who remained in attendance during my visit. As I entered the chamber, I looked about, of course, for the occupant, but did not immediately perceive him. There was a large and exceedingly odd-looking bundle of something which lay close by my feet on the floor, and as I was not in the best humour in the world, I gave it a kick out of the way.
"Rather civil, that, I should say,"
said the bundle, in one of the smallest and altogether the funniest little voices, between a squeak and a whistle, that I ever heard in all the days of my existence.
"Rather civil, that, I should observe."
I fairly shouted with terror, and made off at a tangent into the furthest extremity of the room.
"God bless me, my dear fellow!"
Here again whistled the bundle.
What is the matter? I really believe you don't know me at all."
What could I say to all this? What could I? I staggered into an armchair, and with staring eyes and open mouth awaited the solution of the wonder.
"Strange you shouldn't know me, though, isn't it?"
presently re-squeaked the nondescript, which I now perceived was performing upon the floor some inexplicable evolution very analogous to the drawing on of a stocking. There was only a single leg, however, apparent.
"Strange you shouldn't know me, though, isn't it? Pompey, bring me that leg."
Here Pompey handed the bundle a very capital cork leg, already dressed, which it screwed on in a trice, and then it stood up before my eyes.
"And a bloody action it was,"
continued the thing, as if in a soliloquy.
"But then one man's fight with the bugaboos and kickapoos, and think of coming off with a mere scratch. Pompey, I'll thank you now for that arm. Thomas,"
turning to me,
"is decidedly the best hand at a cork leg. But if you should ever want an arm, my dear fellow, you must really let me recommend you to Bishop.